That is through your word we pray, Lord God. Help us to see the magnificence of all that Jesus has done for us and allow us to rejoice in him in all way for Jesus' sake. Amen. The African Charter is a charter on human and people's rights, of which South Africa is a signatory. And within the African Charter, it states that every single person in Africa has the right to a fair and public hearing by a competent, independent, and impartial tribunal. It states that an individual has the right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. We have the right to be informed promptly of the nature and the cause of the charge. That we have adequate time and facilities for the preparation of his or her defense. That we are tried in his or her presence to defend himself or herself in person through a lawyer of his or her own choice. To be provided with state-funded legal assistance where the defendant is unable to afford a lawyer. To examine or have examined witnesses against him or her, and to call witnesses to testify on his or her behalf. To have free assistance of an interpreter if he or she cannot understand the language used in court. Not to be compelled to testify against himself or herself or to confess guilt. Basically the Fifth Amendment in America. To appeal to a higher tribunal. Compensation if final conviction is reversed or if there's a pardon by reason of a miscarriage of justice. And finally, not to be tried or punished again for an offence which he or she already has been convicted or acquitted, finally. What makes this document so vital for us as individuals is that it assures us in law that we have a right to be tried fairly in our presence, in the company of witnesses. Because too many people have been blamed for crimes that they did not commit, or others are exonerated while they have patently been guilty on a number of charges. And we don't appreciate the magnitude of a document like this until we or a close family member or friend suddenly is on the wrong side of justice. We then summon all the help we can get to ensure that this is faithfully applied to our situation if our rights have been violated. And if that's what we as human beings hold to, as sinful individuals, we know what is right and what is wrong, then how can a holy, righteous God allow the miscarriage of justice in Jesus' case? If God says that the guilty need to be punished and the righteous ought to walk free, why was Jesus tried and condemned for a crime he did not commit? God set out very clear rules in his word. He wrote who was and who was not to be tried, under what sentence they were, how a lawful sentence was a right conviction. Added to the law that they've got, the Jews have the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and that is called the law, and they hold to the law, and every year the religious leaders need to read the law. But added to the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, they've got the Mishnah. And the Mishnah came in after Moses gave the law to them, and that was the oral tradition of how that law was to be applied. And then after that, there were a couple of interpretations. And so added to the Mishnah, they've got the Talmud. And the Talmud was detailed ways in which you maintain justice. It started in about 400-500 BC during the Babylonian age, and then it carried on right through to about 500 AD. But the most of it was established before Christ was even born. And so we've got the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, we've got the Mishnah, the written tradition, and then we've got the Talmud, a commentary on the written tradition. And those were all in place before Jesus even came into this world. before he was sentenced or tried. And working through Deuteronomy has given us a great foundation to see how Jesus' trial should have gone. And so my job today is to show you this mistrial. And because I've got 9 points, yes, you heard correctly, I've got 9 points, not just three, I've put them down for you in your notice leaflet. If you've got a notice leaflet and you want to have a look at where we're going, or you're totally bored and you want to see how far we've still got to go, it's there for you. It's written down with Bible references. Where you see Sanhedrin chapter 5, paragraph 5, or whatever it is, you know that it comes from the Mishnah or from the Torah. So that's just to give you a guideline as to where we're going. I want you to just focus, and we're going to go quite quickly through these, otherwise you're going to still be here tomorrow. So I'm going to keep to my notes and try and go through quickly. Looking through Deuteronomy, a fair trial needed to be enforced because you weren't allowed to pay a witness. Now you know that Judas was betrayed Jesus. Judas betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. And that's reinforced for us in the Gospels. One of the 12, Matthew chapter 26. One called Judas Iscariot went to the chief priests and asked, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" So they counted out for him 30 silver coins. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Direct contravention of the law. And it's not even that it's sort of, well, did they really pay him? Because he brought the coins back. Remember, he brought them back to the religious leaders, threw them on the ground. And we're even told what they did with the money. They bought the potter's field where he committed suicide. So it's not just, oh, I've heard that maybe this happened. That goes directly against Deuteronomy chapter 16. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. Judas, by throwing the money back at the feet of the people who gave him the money in the first place, did not exonerate Jesus. And it didn't reverse the verdict that they brought to put Jesus to death. It doesn't matter what the outcome was. It doesn't matter how much money he was given. The amount isn't important. The fact was, he broke the law of God by taking money as a bribe to be a witness. Secondly, we notice that no decisions were to be made behind closed doors. So I'm going to pick up on Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 9 and 10. Somewhere around here, Deuteronomy 17, 9 and 10. There we go. Go to the priests and the Levites, and to the judge who is in office at the time. Inquire of them, and they will give you the verdict. You must act according to the decisions they give you at the place the Lord will choose. Be careful to do everything they direct you to. So what was the place that the Lord had chosen? According to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin chapter 11, second paragraph, it was known as the Chamber of Hewn Stone, and that was in the temple. And the reason they would have trials there was because it was open. Everybody could come and listen. You were tried not just in a closed room by a couple of people. It was an open court. Now, Jesus was tried by the Sanhedrin. We'll get into a little bit more of that later. But he was tried in the temple. But that was after he had been to Annas' house and after he had been to Caiaphas' house. And in both instances, they found him guilty. And all they did in the temple was to rubber stamp those first two previous trials. The third requirement of the law was that there had to be a concrete accusation. So forgive me for covering a little bit of the ground from last time. But because the trials go into each other, one sermon is going to bleed into the other to a certain degree. So we dealt with a little bit of this at his arrest, but I want to show you how they concocted things. So if a man or woman living among you in one of the towns, the Lord your God gives you, is found doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, You must investigate it thoroughly, verse 4. Last week we said that there was no charge. When they came to arrest Jesus, one of the laws was you had to have the charge. Why are you arresting me? What have I done wrong? And to make this point even clearer, the charge that they give to Jesus at Caiaphas's house is that of blasphemy. And as soon as they go to the Romans, what's the charge against him then? Insurrection. He wants to overthrow the Romans. So there's no clarity as to what this charge is against him. Now I realize, because there is no charge documented in the Gospels, that's a weak argument to say there was no. But I want to dispel this by saying, when Jesus was presented to them, they asked him, "What are you guilty of?" That's the perfect way to bring in intimidation, which is a point that I'll make later. But when you've got somebody standing in front of you and you say, "Do you know why you're here?" And the accused person says, "Well, I think it might be because of X, Y, and Z." Your accusers, who haven't laid a charge against you, can pick up on that and say, "You see, it's even coming from your lips. Do you see exactly what we're saying? This is what we're charging you for." And there's brutal intimidation. So the reason I had part of John 18 read to you was you listen to the words of Jesus. When they ask him, "Why are you here?" He says, "I've spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together, and I've said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard. Surely they know what I said." He's saying, "You've brought me here. You haven't laid a charge against me. Lay the charge on the basis of what you've heard, because I've said nothing in secret." And to show you how the intimidation works, when Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. "If I said something wrong," Jesus replied, "testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?" The fourth aspect of this mistrial was that there needs to be a credible witness. You need to have credible witnesses. Deuteronomy chapter 17. "On the testimony of two or three witnesses, a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. The hands of the witnesses must be the first in putting him to death. Then all the hands of all the people, you must purge evil from among you." Not only one witness. When we get back to the series in Deuteronomy, we'll get to chapter 19. Once again, it is reinforced. One witness is not enough to convict a man accused of any crime or offense he may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. So when you get home, you see in your notes that I'm referring to Mark chapter 14. Again, another passage that you can read through at your leisure and see how it ties in. But in Mark 14, it says that the Jews were looking for reasons, evidence against Jesus, so that they could put him to death. But they didn't find any. How unjust that is. I've reached my sentence. I've got the conclusion. I've got a verdict. Now I've got to find stuff to substantiate my verdict. If you read through Mark's Gospel, chapter 14, the accusations didn't tie with the reason given for the trial. And when they brought witnesses, Mark tells us that the witnesses did not even agree. And then they asked Jesus, "So what do you think of these statements?" To heap even more condemnation on this mistrial, I'll tell you some of the rules that the Jews had established. According to Mishnah chapter 5, paragraph 2, "At a time when witnesses contradict one another, their testimony is void." Don't believe either of them. Toss them out. In fact, don't toss them out. I was reading the Mishnah this morning as I was preparing again for it. And chapter 5 of the Mishnah says, if a person is found to be a false witness, he shall be put to death without warning. Take him straight out and kill him. Now, that would make you think twice about whether you were prepared to be a false witness. Along with that, in terms of witnesses, the law of God says that if somebody bears witness against a person in a trial, he might not be the judge. He may not be the judge. And Caiaphas testifies against Jesus and he says, I've heard it with my own ears. He's being a witness in a case that he's therefore not allowed to judge. Apart from that, Caiaphas witnesses that Jesus says he is the Son of God, and he never questions whether that might not be true. There's no question as to whether possibly Jesus is the Son of God, and no consideration is ever given to that fact. We're on number 5. Jewish law forbids intimidation. We've touched on that on the passage above. But because intimidation is forbidden, Leviticus 19 verse 15 and 16 says, do not pervert justice, do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly. Do not go about spreading slander among the people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. I am the Lord. That's contrary to the events of that fateful evening when they took Jesus in and they condemned him to death. And they spat on him. That's intimidation. They beat him. They slapped him. Hit him with their fists. They said, prophesy if you are the Son of God. And these are the rules that are inscribed in the collective memory of all the Jews. Everybody was to have a fair and transparent hearing. And they're not only written on their hearts, but they were read in the synagogues year after year. And these people who should have been the defenders of innocent people turn out to be the perpetrators of some of the most inhumane treatment of anybody. And the inhumane treatment didn't stop when they let Jesus go and gave him over to the Romans. Their condemnation of Jesus and their mocking continued even when he was up on the cross. The verbal abuse from the religious leaders continued. Matthew 27. In the same way, listen to who they were. The chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him if he wants him. For he said, I am the Son of God. And in the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. My last major point is that it was a crime, so it was forbidden for a crime to be judged and for sentence to be handed down on the same day. So up to now, I've quoted all the passages from the scriptures. Now I'm only quoting from the Mishnah, Sanhedrin chapter 5, paragraph 5. If they found him innocent, once they had had the trial, they would set him free. Otherwise, they would leave it over for the following day. In the meantime, they would go away together in pairs, all 70 of them. They would eat very little, and they were to drink no wine that whole day. They'd discuss the matter all night, and early in the next morning, they would return to the court. If you favored the acquittal on the previous day, you would say, I declare him innocent, and I still declare him innocent. And if, after a night of thinking and meditating on this case, you thought the guy is still guilty, you would say, I declare him guilty and I still declare him guilty. So you've had a night to think about it and you can still keep your same opinion. If your opinion changed, it says, he that favored conviction may now acquit him. But if you favored acquittal the day before, you may not condemn him. Do you see how everything was stacked in the favor of the person accused. Things aren't clear. You need to spend a night in thinking about what the person has done. You come back the following day. You have another day set for the trial. And you either say this guy was guilty and now we acquit him after reasonable thought. Take out all the emotion. And give him the best chance to be proven innocent without the emotions playing a part. But you couldn't change from innocent to guilty overnight. This so-called justice that they judged Jesus with was contrary to all those laws that we've given. How many of them? Well, it's six at this point. I'm going to touch on three other rules. These rules are not in the scriptures, but they were in the Mishnah. They were in the commentary of the written code. No part of the trial involving a capital offense could be conducted at night. When did they arrest Jesus? Late into the evening. Early the following morning, early hours of Friday morning, they took him to Annas. Later in that morning, they took him around the corner to Caiaphas, the high priest. Only at sunrise did they take him to the Sanhedrin. And then they took him to Pilate. He went to Herod and then he went back to Pilate. But the main part of the trial where he was condemned was at night. This is the rule. Sanhedrin chapter 4, paragraph 1. In cases of capital law, the court judges during the daytime and concludes deliberations and issues the ruling only in daytime. They could get by it by just saying, oh, well, by the time we came to the Sanhedrin, it was daytime. But all the trial had happened. All they were doing was verifying what they had already decided. And then in John chapter 18, they go through Caiaphas' home and then only to the Sanhedrin thereafter. The defense is supposed to lead the case. Same paragraph as above. The court opens the deliberations with a claim to acquit the accused, but it does not open the deliberations with a claim to find him liable. In other words, you can't start your case saying, this is the evidence we've got against you. The case is mentioned, and once you know what you're accused of, the defense always offers the first voice. How could Jesus defend himself when he wasn't even formally charged? The last thing, the Fifth Amendment. It's stronger than the Fifth Amendment in the United States. You don't say anything about yourself if it might be used to your detriment. You can't convict, or you could, but you're given the choice to say nothing in case it incriminates you. The whole way through the trial, they were asking Jesus to incriminate himself. Laws are put in place to protect the innocent. They're flouted when the people who are judging you don't want justice. They just want you. In God's incredible mercy, he allows all these rules to be pushed aside so that Jesus is condemned as a totally innocent man. Because only one who is innocent can stand in the place of one who is guilty. If Jesus was guilty of any crime, he could not have taken your place. And yet, these are just the Roman, the Jewish laws that have been flouted. Next week, Good Friday, we'll see him taken to the Romans. And I'll tell you, the Romans had rules as well as to how citizens were to be treated. And it was a miscarriage of justice as well. In the arrest, in the Jewish law, and in the Roman law. And we come together next Sunday, and next Sunday I'm going to say why Jesus was condemned and left to die on a cross, and pull the whole series together. He fulfilled all the requirements of the law. He died as someone innocent that we would be set free. We're going to spend a couple of moments recognizing again that Christ died for us individually. I'm not speaking about died for Christ Church Hilton. I'm speaking about me, you. This was all done for you. And he could have pleaded this constitutional right to be heard, whatever he wanted to. And yet he remained silent for you. Then after that, we're going to just read part of Psalm 53. Seeing how innocent he was, and yet he was treated as a criminal.